As always, I have to finish up last week's lecture. But soon I'll be a full lecture behind, so. For whatever that's worth. Okay. So we were discussing the local L functions. And we were in the case where K was a non-Archimedean local field. And I think I've always really taken it to be characteristic zero. That doesn't really matter. Everything that I say works in characteristic P. It's just not the most useful way to do things in characteristic P. And then it's got its ring of integers, maximal ideal, uniformizer, all that good stuff. Let me remind you what our family of integrals is, because I'll refer to this a couple of times. Let me write it and then I'll remind you what things are. So these are the family of integrals we're looking at, where W is in the Whitaker model of pi with respect to some additive character. So pi is a representation of GL n, usual kind, smooth, admissible, irreducible, generic. And W prime is in the Whitaker model of pi prime with respect to the inverse character, where pi prime is a representation of GLM, also of the usual kind. Now, what we had done last time is we had considered the span of this family of integrals. Well, we looked at these integrals and others, but these are the most important ones. We looked at the complex span of these as W and W prime vary. And we had said that this is a C, a joined Q to the S, Q to the minus S fractional ideal in rational functions in Q to the minus S. And then we had defined the local L function to be the generator of this ideal of the form 1 over a polynomial in Q to the minus S. So this is the normalized generator of this ideal. Okay, that's where we were at the end of the day last Tuesday. Okay, is this okay? This seemed to be where we were. So note another way to think about this L function is that it's sort of the minimal factor minimal in terms of divisibility of the form polynomial in Q to the minus S inverse, such that if you divide any one of these integrals by this factor, so that's like clearing the denominators, then that clears out all the poles. So such that if you look at these little ratios, so this is the local integral divided by the L function So I'm dividing by 1 over a polynomial. So that's multiplying by the polynomial. That's clearing the denominators. That this is, in fact, in q to the s, q to the minus s. This is entire. Okay, so it's the minimal factor that kills all poles, if you like. So it kills all poles. Okay. Now, here's something else to note. Since it is a generator, it's actually in the ideal. And since this ideal is the span of these integrals, that means that I can actually write the L function as a sum, I equals 1 to who knows what, doesn't matter, some finite sum of local integrals. Right, because those things, it's the complex span of those that give me this ideal. So that's in there, so I can do that. And this will be important. I mean, right now it just looks like a silly thing, but that actually is going to be quite important when it comes to deriving the global theory from the local theory. So you get this. Also, then, if you divide by this, you get that 1 is equal to the sum, I equals 1 to R, of those ratios. Is that what I wanted? Yes. Okay. And this tells me something about these ratios. So if I put that and this together, we get the following, well, let me call it just, I can't call it a corollary because I don't have anything up there for it to be a corollary of. So let me just call it a fact. The functions, these local ratios, are entire. That's just sort of by definition of the L function. They're bounded in vertical strips, because they're just polynomials in q to the s and q to the minus s. So when I put on absolute values, I get q to the real part of s, q to the minus real part of s. So the absolute values of these things only depend on the real part of s. So they're bounded in vertical strips. This, how I got this? I took this equation and divided by L. That makes this side 1, and this side is exactly those ratios. Yeah, so I'm always sticking to m less than n. That is inessential. Everything that I say is true for m equals n. It's just that the integrals look slightly different. You have to do things, yeah, with the Eisenstein series or the unfolded. I mean, here it's just the unfolded thing. So you no longer have the Eisenstein series. You just have the Schwarz function. But everything that I say is still true in the m equals n case. The integrals still give me a fractional ideal. There is a generator. That's the L function. These ratios will still be entire and bounded in vertical strips. And, again, the next thing I'm going to write is going to be important when we go relate the local to the global theory. The fact that this sum is equal to 1 means that for any complex number, there's a choice of W and W prime. Such that this ratio does not vanish. Okay? In particular, you can take for these, one of these R things I've written here. Right? Because if the sum is 1, they can't all I mean, even at S naught, the sum is 1, so they can't all be 0. Okay. All right. Let me make sure I'm where I want to be. So that's, yeah, that's the corollary of some. Oh, I see. Okay. Right. In my notes, this was a proposition, so that was a corollary. Okay. So this is just sort of basic stuff coming from the fact that the L function is defined as the generator of an ideal. Now, next let me turn to the local functional equation. Now, if you remember what the global functional equation looked like, we had a global functional equation for our global integrals, and then both sides of it factored into local integrals. Okay? So, from the global functional equation, we expect, so the global functional equation and the Euler factorizations, we expect a relation between, well, this was what was on one side of that functional equation, and the thing that was on the other side, we had denoted psi tilde 1 minus s, right translation by a certain vial element, w tilde prime. Okay? So this was, we had a global functional equation, one side of it unfolded to these integrals, the other side unfolded to these integrals, and so locally we would then expect some sort of local functional equation relating these. Okay? Now, there will be such a relation, and this will follow from viewing these integrals as bilinear forms on, say, the Whitaker model for pi and the Whitaker model for pi prime. Okay? In the sense that they're both going to satisfy certain quasi-invariance properties, and then what one proves is that bilinear forms with those quasi-invariance properties are unique. And so if they both have those properties and such things are unique, then you get an equality at least up to some factor. Okay. So is bilinear, in fact, yeah, okay. So, so let's see. So viewing the pair W prime goes to this integral that's up there as a bilinear form. It satisfies certain quasi-invariants. Namely, well, the first one it satisfies is what happens if you take this integral and you, in this variable, you right translate by something in GLM, and in this variable, you right translate, whoops, I forgot the Whitaker function, sorry. Right, and remember in the Whitaker models, the representation is x by right translation. So this is both right translating this and right translating this by some h in GLM. Okay? Well, if you right translate, well, I guess I got an h there, so let me make this h, h0. Okay? Well, if I right translate here, in these two functions, I just do the change of variables in this then becomes determinant with an H naught inverse here, which just factors out and comes out. So we get absolute determinant H naught to the minus S plus N minus M over 2. WS psi S WW prime. So I get this for all H naught in GLMK. I can just read it off of there. And now there's another quasi-invariance that you can read off. Namely, if I right translate here by sort of a lower triangular matrix, okay, or some sort of unipotent matrix, it can conjugate past this and then come out with an additive character. Okay, so anything I can sort of move past this will come out with an additive character. Okay, and so the second invariance is the following. For all y n, and now when you analyze it, the group that comes up is this old group that we talked about in our projection operator. It's a set of matrices of the form ym plus 1, x, anything up here, such that x is a unipotent matrix of size n minus m minus 1. Okay, and that's contained in upper triangular matrices. This was the thing that we integrated over to get our projection operator. No. But I can. I think I can. Yeah, so W, if I remember correctly, it's an identity here, and that there, and now the question is just what the sizes are, and I'll be more than glad to look it up if I can find it. Is that the way it is? M and N minus M? Okay. So this is M, and then this block then is an N minus M. So that's the vial element that occurs. Anyway, if you take something like this and you do the change of variables up there, then what happens is then... I want to leave that up because I may need that again. Then so I'm going to do right translation by an element like that up here. Okay. And when you do, it comes past the H, I, N minus M. Now, when you do, you may get something happening here, but the additive character psi doesn't see anything here. It just sees these super diagonal elements. So the additive character is only going to see this part down here. Okay. And what happens when you do that little exercise is you get psi of Y. And this is for all y and n. So you get both of these quasi-invariance properties for this bilinear form. Okay. Now, so that's the first thing. And those are the obvious ones for that family of integrals. And now a rather painful exercise is to show that that family of integrals has exactly the same quasi-invariance. Okay. So then a somewhat painful exercise shows that if you look at ww prime going to this other integral. That this has exactly the same quasi-invariance properties. Again, it's not a difficult exercise, it's just a rather painful one. And then what one needs then to relate these is, well, now you know what you have to do. You have to prove that there is only one such bilinear form. And so here's then the proposition that you have to prove. And it says up to a finite number of exceptional. No. Hold on. I mean, what I'm going to write is, I wasn't going to write anything. That's what I have. So up to a finite number of exceptional values of q to the minus s, there is a unique bilinear form, I'll call it b sub s, mapping w pi psi cross w pi prime psi inverse to C, satisfying one. Did I call them one and two? Did I call them anything? One and two. Okay. And the proof of this, actually, the proof of this is exactly the sort of thing that Moshe was talking about last Thursday. You prove it using Bruha theory or distribution theory. You prove that. Anyway, not something that I plan on doing. Okay, but the proof sort of takes place in the Kirilov model. From an exercise in Bruhn theory. Okay. So there's a uniqueness statement. Or, actually, if you've been around since January, you'll remember that Bernstein proved some things where he set some things up and then he said there's a uniqueness theorem. And he got some equalities. It's exactly the same type of argument here. You prove that certain sorts of bilinear forms are unique. So he had trilinear forms. But it's the same. It's the same principle. It's the same idea. And then if you put this sort of elementary calculation, this painful calculation, and this uniqueness statement together, then you get the local functional equation. And it says there exists. So notice that these things for a fixed S. Okay, so this is for a fixed S because the quasi-invariance properties depend on S. For a fixed S, there's a unique thing. So these two things will differ by something that may depend on S. So they'll differ by a function of S. Okay? So there exists, and in fact, it will be a rational function. And I'm going to call it gamma pi times pi prime psi. So it's a rational function, mq to the minus s, such that psi tilde 1 minus s, right translation wnm, W tilde prime equals to, and now the normalizations here are slightly a mess, so there's a sort of a fudge factor. You put the central character of pi prime evaluated at minus 1 to the n minus 1. That's a factor that globally isn't going to matter because this will be automorphic and that's rational and this will go away globally. But locally, the way that they've set things up, it's there. And then here is that factor of proportionality between these two quasi-invariant functionals, psi s w w prime. And so that gives you everything except for the rationality, but you get some complex function that relates these two things, and then you just divide that by that. Those are both rational functions, so gamma has to be rational. So that's the so-called local gamma factor. And it has in it actually everything you need in it. It's got the two representations. It's got both S and Psi, but that makes sense because the quasi-invariance depends on both S and Psi. So that's what the local function equation looks like. Now, we can write this in a different way. Is that okay where that comes from? So this gamma factor is a very important local invariant of this pair of representations, and we'll see it and another variant of it. We'll see how they play out in the theory. So the other variant of this, so there's a useful of the local gamma factor, and this is the local epsilon factor. Okay? And it's defined in the following way. I basically, once I have this relation, I can, so we know this is a rational function and this is a rational function. If I divide this by the proper L function, this becomes polynomial. And if I divide this by the proper L function, this becomes polynomial. And those are just functions of S. So that'll give me something else here that only differs by this, by a couple of functions of S. So the local epsilon factor defined by, so let me write what the local functional equation looks like for this. So I take this and I divide it by the relative L function that this thing defines. So it's going to be L at 1 minus S. This lives in the contrigredient of pi. That lives in the contrigredient of pi prime. So I divide there. I still have omega pi prime to the minus 1 n minus 1. And then this is going to be my new factor of proportionality, epsilon s pi times pi prime psi. And then on this side, I do the same thing. Okay, so it's defined in such a way. So now let's see. So the gamma factor is, where'd the gamma factor go? There it is. So is epsilon and then this has to come over. That's just a function of S and then this has to come over. Okay, so that's the way the local, that's the relation between gamma and epsilon. I guess I should have done it the other way, actually. But okay, sorry. Well, I know it's correct, but if I'm defining epsilon, I should have solved for epsilon instead of solving for gamma. Okay, so there's another not so painful exercise to divide by these two factors. Okay. To divide by these two factors. Now, no, the gamma factor will not be, the epsilon factor will be. It's the epsilon factor that will be. The gamma is, so in some sense, the thing that arises naturally is gamma, because it comes from comparing these two invariant bilinear forms that have a uniqueness. So in some sense, gamma occurs naturally here, and it's the thing that you can sort of prove things about using this relation. Okay? The epsilon factor, in some sense, is the more arithmetic factor somehow. And that's right. Globally, that's what's going to occur in the functional equation. Okay? So let me show you some things that you can say about epsilon and tell you some sort of, some information that's in epsilon. So, here's some facts about epsilon. Well, first, recall since we can write LS pi times pi prime as a finite sum of these local integrals, okay, remember we had that just because that was the generator. So if I take that expression up there and look at the sum, I take that expression for each one of each pair and add them up, right? Then on the right hand side I'm just going to get epsilon, and on the left hand side I'm going to get a sum of terms like that. Okay? So if we write this, then I get a sum I equals 1 to R, and these are those ratios that I had before. So let me just call this E 1 minus S R W and M W tilde prime is omega pi prime minus 1 to the N minus 1 epsilon S pi times pi prime sine. Is that right? Or is there something else? Right? That's just adding that relation up and using the fact that on the right-hand side those terms sum to 1, and on the left-hand they're just whatever these little ratios are. But these little ratios, those are local integrals for that L function. These are polynomials in Q to the S and Q to the minus S. So this is a polynomial in Q to the S and Q to the minus S. Okay. So that's the first thing, is that this is a very nice factor. Okay. The gamma may be more complicated, but this is relatively nice. Okay. Now, another thing we can do is use, if we apply the local functional equation twice, so if you apply the local functional equation twice, you find out that epsilon S pi times pi prime times epsilon 1 minus S pi contragradient times pi contragradient prime psi inverse is 1. Right? You apply the thing twice, you're back where you started. Okay? So you get that this product is equal to 1, which means that those epsilon factors are units in this ring. Okay, but what do the units look like? Well, they look like constants times Q to the minus S. Or power of Q to the minus S, power of Q to the S. So, here's a proposition. Epsilon S pi times pi prime psi is of the form C Q to the minus FS. It's a monomial factor. So these are the nice things. The gamma factors have this times the ratio of L functions, so it's a much more complicated rational function. But this is the one that's nice. Okay, so those are the sort of the two basic facts about epsilon that we're going to derive. One is that, and the other one, well, I guess just that. This was the other one, but that one's subsumed, so that's what we want over there. Okay. Now, let me tell you, I would like to tell you now some the information that's contained in this. Okay? So, this, if you like, I'm not going to prove anything, of course. Whoa. You mean it doesn't live in SL? I think that's correct. But I've never... So the point is if you choose this vial element slightly differently, okay, to put it in SL, then it's possible that this factor then disappears. Okay? That this in some sense is there because you've not normalized things correctly. Okay? And that may very well be true. I have not worked it out. And I've left it like this basically because this is, if you... Well, that's the way that it appears in the papers of Jacquet and P.S. and Shalika. And so, just to be consistent with what they do, I've left it. But yeah, I mean, it is the sort of thing that I think should be normalized away. It really doesn't belong there. But. Okay. So let me. I want to tell you a little bit about the information that's contained in this. Okay. So I want to tell you about the conductor. Of a representation. Okay. So let me go to the situation. I now want to take. Okay, so this is really. Well, okay. So I want to take pi prime to be chi naught, to be the trivial character of GL1. Okay? So epsilon s pi times chi naught, just as for the L function, when we had this is the trivial character on GL1, this was just epsilon pi. This is now just epsilon s pi psi. This is sort of by definition. Okay, because that's the way we defined the L function of pi, was to take the pi prime just to be the trivial character on GL1. Okay? And I want to take psi to be unramified and normalized. And by this, unramified always means it's trivial on the maximal compact. The maximal compact subring of K is the ring of integers. So I want psi on the ring of integers to be 1. But then as soon as you get off the ring of integers, I want on the inverse of the uniformizer, I want it to be not 1. So I'm going to take that situation.
When you
here? No, because this is the way, this is the way that we defined LS pi was as LS pi times chi naught, where chi naught's a trivial character on GL1. So similarly, this is the way that you would, this is then the L function, the epsilon factor just of pi. Oh, that is chi naught, sorry. Sorry, it was just tiny. Okay? And then let me write, I'm going to write my epsilon factor as the epsilon factor at a half times q to the minus a number I'll call f pi s minus a half. Okay, so that's just, I've just taken this formula and normalized it somehow. Okay? I'm just going to write it that way. Okay. So. Now, when you do this, when you do it this way, it turns out that this piece has norm 1. Okay, so this is the so-called root number. The classical root. You're the one that has that bad habit. I wondered who started that. Nothing. So this is the root number. And this is a subtle invariant. If you remember in January, if you were here when Erez Lapid talked, these are the root numbers that he talked about. Okay? And he gave you some indication of the information that was contained in them. I'm not going to talk about that, but I would like to tell you what information is in this integer here. This f pi. Okay? So here's a result of Jack K. P.S. and Schleicha explained the meaning, if you like, or the information, at least some of the information about pi contained in this integer. Okay, so right now all I know is that it's an integer. And so here are the properties of f pi. First property is that, in fact, it's always positive or non-negative. Okay, it's always a non-negative integer when you write things like that. Well, no, but it's the S. And I can't... No, because, see, that's a constant. That's a constant. This is a variable. So, no, he can't. No. C is a constant here. So, this is... So, that's a non-trivial fact. That's a non-trivial fact that that's non-negative. Yeah. Second, and this we may actually prove next time, is that... It's zero if and only if pi is unramified, i.e. has a non-zero vector fixed by the maximal compact. So there's a piece of information that's contained there. But in fact, it contains more information. So for t bigger than or equal to 0, I want to let k1 of p to the t be the set of all, it's going to be the subset of the maximal compact subgroup with the following congruence property. And so it's the same sort of congruence property that classically you think of as defining gamma 1 of n or gamma 1 of p. So it's got to be congruent to, well, it's got to be congruent to something in the mirabolic, of course. Mod p to the t. Okay, so this is a compact open subgroup, finite index in the maximal compact. Okay. And then the other piece of information that's contained in this integer is for t between 0 and this integer f pi that occurs in the epsilon factor, then the space of k1 p the t fixed vectors in pi is only the 0 vector, so they're not any. And when this level, if you like, hits this point, then you get exactly one fixed vector up to scalars. So the dimension over C of V pi fixed by K1 P to the F pi is 1. Psi either is a unique up to scalars. Non-zero k1 p f pi vector. Okay. Now, of course, if f pi is 0, then we've recovered that if a representation is unramified, there's a unique k fixed vector. Okay. So then either depends on who you read, either f pi or the ideal p to the f pi is called the conductor of the representation. Okay. So there is, if you like, even though this epsilon factor was completely determined and defined by this theory of local L functions. Okay? So in some sense, these two invariants, this local root number and this integer, this conductor, are defined purely from the point of view of L functions. At least in the case of the conductor, you can see it really contains structural information about the representation. Okay? Here? No, well, the point is that if I look at a level below f of pi, there are no k1, there are no fixed vectors. When you hit f pi, you get 1. And above f pi, there can be whoever knows how many. Okay, but that measures, that integer measures the place where you begin to get fixed vectors under that compact open subgroup. Okay, so that's what it measures. Why not? Well, that's like, well.
Greater than or something.
Well, the lower bound is zero. The question is, there's an upper bound, and if there's an upper bound, that basically says, classically, if you start letting the level get deeper and deeper and deeper, at some point you get no new modular forms, which strikes me as being strange. Is that a fact? What? Yeah, and this is the yeah. I don't know. That I don't know. I don't know if you can skip a level or not. Yeah. Pi and f of pi prime. That may be. That may be. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, this is, I mean, this is, if you like, this vector in here is the local new vector, or local new form. Yeah. This is measuring the point at which something new occurs. Well, this I said I wasn't going to say anything about that. I don't have. Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, I think they're, in some sense, they're complicated numbers. They're more subtle. You cannot take arbitrary complex numbers. No, they don't. Right. But yeah, I think this is a much more subtle invariant than this. But this already tells you, I mean, that this stuff, there's surprising content in these things. Because I think as I led you along the garden path here, I gave you no reason to think that anything like this would be true. Right. I've already told you as much, if not more, than I actually know about the root numbers. It's not, yeah, in fact, from what I've given you, it's not even clear that it has absolute value 1. From what I've told you so far. Well, yeah. Well, I know. Yeah, because of the classical theory. I mean, that's, you pull out, see, in some sense, that's the sign. That's the sign. If it's self-contradictory. If they're not self-dual, then this just tells you you have two things that multiply to give you two units. Yeah. Yeah, for classical forms there are. But I mean, yeah, I mean, right, this is just the power of Q. And that's the, you've sort of pull out the thing that's the sign. That's the sign. Okay. And signs of functional equations of L functions have been very interesting for a long time.
Is there also theory of inductors called non-generic forms?
Well, remember, because I said this, for non-generic forms, you just, so the answer is yes, there is. And here you can take to the classification. Yep. Yep. Well, what do you mean? I mean, this is attached to pi. That in that case, it's attached to pi.
Okay.
Right. There's a unique such induced that has that as a quotient, and so it's canonically attached to pi, and it's the same invariant, and I believe it has the same information. Oh, yeah. So that makes it a more subtle theorem.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think it's, I believe it's still.
I don't know.
I believe it's still true. I believe it is still true even there. It is, I mean, it is, I mean, it's true for the unramified thing at least. Yeah. Well, so the question is, if my representation is not generic, so to do this theory I have to replace the Whitaker model for the representation with the Whitaker model for this induced representation, for which this is the quotient, right? Does this invariant see a K1 fixed vector in my representation, or does it see it in this full induced thing? I don't know. I'll have to look. Well, but then you have to have a way of knowing where you pick up the first invariant vector, too. Well, but remember even from the stuff of Bushnell and Cusco, once you start twisting things. Well, no, except when you... Well, I don't know. That's the real answer is now I don't know. I'd have to look and think. Mm-hmm. Well, and it may be, it's been a while since I've looked at the paper. It may very well be that the last two lines of the paper are, if you do this exercise, you get this in general. I don't know. On the other hand, I will admit that sometimes these guys are very bad about telling you not everything they know, but just everything they want to tell you. Which means in their paper, no. What that means is if you read their papers and you want to know if a piece of information is there, you do not just read the statements of the theorems, because they will state the theorems that are related to what they're trying to prove. They may very well have proven more in the context of the arguments. I mean, this is quite... Well, sometimes they make the... No, in the remarks, they tell you about things that they can prove, that they may or may not have really given the full argument for. But there are plenty of things in there that they've proven but haven't chosen to pull out as a statement. So that's my aside on mathematical sociology or psychology. Yeah, so which one of these three are you going to email and say, in your paper of such and such a year, did you really prove this? Or did you prove what you stated? That's what I'm saying. Oh, well. That's right, it was never written down. I know. So it is now, but... Yeah, but the point is, you could have gotten it out of their papers. I mean, they did everything necessary to do it. They just, it wasn't what they were interested in, and so they didn't write it down. Okay. Marching strongly into the past. Okay, I want to, I was going to try to compute the unramified L function today. I may still try to start. But I want to tell you two more facts that come out of the local theory that at some point we will need, but I am definitely not going to prove. Even less so than here, I at least try to give you the arguments that indicate why things are true. So here's two side results. Local theory. And they're both about this invariant gamma that I've erased. okay? Which means they can translate into something about epsilon. The first one is the so-called multiplicativity. Of gamma, and it tells me the behavior of gamma if one of my representations is induced. And it basically says the following. Suppose I have pi, which is induced from two other representations. So let's say pi 1 is a representation of GL R1, pi 2 a representation of GL R2, of the usual kind, then if you look at the gamma factor, S pi twisted by pi prime, that's still my GLM guy from before, then this is multiplicative sort of in the variable pi, which means this factors into gamma S pi 1 twisted by pi prime and gamma S pi 2 twisted by pi prime. So that's the multiplicativity of gamma. It's multiplicative. No, because the gamma factor doesn't really care. So I think the answer is no. I believe so. I've never had to use it really in the Archimedean case, so I've never really worried about it. The proof is just relating the Whitaker model to pi to the Whitaker model of these two representations and then seeing what sorts out. So there's the so-called multiplicativity. There's also multiplicativity in the second variable. If pi prime's induced, you have a similar statement. And you also get, there's sort of a fact about the L function. The L function itself doesn't factor, but you do have a divisibility statement for the L function. So also, if you look at LS pi times pi prime, and let me take its inverse so it's a polynomial, that divides the product of the other two L functions. So on the L function level, you get a divisibility statement on the level of gamma factors. So that's divides. Right. Well, here they're defined. Right. But this is just. Right. This is very crude. The second one is the so-called stability of the gamma factors. And so here, the statement is the following. And this is an example of a principle that I think has been around for quite a long time that says if you have some sort of arithmetic object and you sort of start twisting it by characters that are highly ramified, then eventually you sort of twist out all information. Okay. And so here it says the following. It says if pi 1 and pi 2 are two usual, irreducible, admissible, generic representations of GLN, then for every highly ramified, sufficiently highly ramified character of GL1 or K cross, if you look at the twisted L, the gamma factor just for pi 1 twisted by eta, and the gamma factor for pi 2 uh-oh, twisted by eta, then I want to say these are equal. And that's not a hypothesis. So let me say, well, I want these to be representations with the same central character. So they have to have the same central character. Then, in fact, once you twist by sufficiently highly ramified characters, these are all equal. That's a so-called stability. They stabilize when you twist by highly ramified characters. Now, here it turns out you can say something about the L functions. So also, LS pi 1 times eta equals LS pi 2 times eta. And in fact, these stabilize to be identically 1, so that the epsilon factors also stabilize. And this is going to be important because when we start later on, when we finally do lifting theories from groups to GLN, this is going to, we're going to need this. We're going to use this to compare L and epsilon factors on different groups. What other one? Yeah, you need both of these. You need both of these because, in fact, if you combine these, you can compute this stable form. Okay? Because the stable form really only depends on the central character. That's what this says. So given pi, take characters mu1 up to μn of GL1 such that their product is the central character of pi. Okay? Then, when I start twisting by highly ramified characters, okay? Well, no, let me stop for a minute. So then, if I look at the full induced from the Borel of these characters, right? This half central character. Well, the central character is the product of the mu i's. That has the same central character as pi. Okay. So, if I combine multiplicativity, now here I've stated multiplicativity for two representations, but by whatever the deal is, for induction, transitivity of induction, that I can, in fact, factor this all down for as many factors as I have here. So then if I combine these two things, gamma S pi twisted by a highly ramified character is gamma S of this induced twisted by a highly ramified character. And this, I just use multiplicativity. This is the product, J equals 1 to N, gamma S mu I eta psi, abelian gamma factors. Or, since the L functions all stabilize to 1, this is just abelian epsilon factors. Okay. So this stable form is something that's explicitly computable. And once it's explicitly computable, you can use that to compare these factors on different groups, if you have such multiplicativity and stability on different groups as well. So that's the importance of these two results. It lets you compare things on different groups. Right? If you like, this is sort of half of a fundamental lemma. Not really. But fundamental lemma is what you use to compare things on two different groups in the trace formula. Right? Huh? Well, but it, in some sense, it plays the same role. It connects two, lets you connect two different groups if you have such statements on those groups as well. Okay. Always. No, it depends on the character. Ada's there. So what it says is, given pi 1 and pi 2, right, I can determine a degree of ramification, and as long as Ada is more ramified than that, I get this equality. Okay? Which means, for sufficiently highly, all sufficiently highly ramified Ada, where sufficiently depends on, in this case, pi and my choice of characters, I have this equality. No, it depends on the two representations. On the two representations. But I usually have two representations on two different groups that I'm trying to compare. Okay? And so that's all, both the groups and the representations are fixed, and then I let Ada go. And I get stable on one group with one representation, stable on the other group with the other representation, and I can compare because I can compute it. All right. Any other questions before I start today's lecture? No. No, because if I forget, no. I have 15 minutes. Anyway, questions about this? Jacquet and Shalika. I'm sorry, yes, for GLM this is... So the multiplicativity is in the paper of Jacquet, Pies, and Shalika. The stability is a paper of just Jacquet and Shalika. And in fact, it has, theirs is a little bit, they prove a little bit more because they actually prove stability of the form gamma s pi 1 tensor eta twisted by pi prime. So they let you twist again. Actually prove a stability like this where you can twist by the same GLM representation as well. So they prove a little bit more. Okay. So let me tell you, go ahead and at least do the introduction to what I'm going to do next Thursday. What I now want to do is I want to do for you the unramifying calculation. Okay? Meaning, I want to take pi, an unramified generic representation of GLN, pi prime, an unramified generic representation of GLM, and still I'm going to stick to M less than N, although everything I do works for the case where they're on the same group. And I want to compute, I'm actually going to compute this. I want to compute that. Okay. Really what I'm going to compute is what the local integral gives if I take for W and W prime the K fixed Whitaker functions. Okay, so W naught and W prime naught are going to be the K fixed Whitaker functions. Right, if these representations are unramified, they have K fixed vectors, which means in the Whitaker model I'll have, this is a k-fixed vector in the Whitaker model of pi, so that's fixed for kn, and this will be k-fixed in the Whitaker model for pi prime, so that'll be km fixed. And I want to compute this integral, and then that'll be the bulk of the story, and then at the end I'll have to relate these two things. But I'm going to compute this integral for you. Okay? Now, it turns out this is going to be very related to an old calculation that we did. It's going to be related to the calculation of the local L factor at a prime P for a classical automorphic form. Okay? So the method is quite intimately connected to the computation of the P Euler factor for LSF with F, say F just some classical modular form. Right, we did that calculation a long time ago. Okay. And in fact, what did we need for this calculation? We needed to know two things for this calculation. We needed to know, one, that F was a Hecke eigenfunction. Right? That was one thing we needed. And then the second thing was to, we needed to know the recursion relation among all the various TPs. We needed to know the recursion relations the TP to the R for a fixed P. Okay, those were the two pieces of information that went into computing the Euler, to showing that the L function had an Euler product and then computing the explicit Euler factors. Okay, those are the two pieces that went in. Okay? So the same thing is going to happen here. And in fact, really what's going to happen is using ideas from here, if you like, what this is going to let us do is actually compute a formula for these K fixed Whitaker vectors. And then once I've got a formula for them, an explicit formula, and once I have that, I'm just going to put them into my integrals and compute. Okay? So here, so similar ideas will let us get explicit formulas for W naught and W prime naught. Okay. Now the Hecke algebra we will use is, well, everything is unramified here, so what we're going to use is the spherical Hecke algebra. And this we talked about back whenever. Third lecture, we talked about this. So it's going to be H, K. So it's going to be, oh, we called it this once. So that's the full Hecke algebra. Those are the idempotents corresponding to the maximal compact subgroup. So if you like, it was smooth functions, so locally constant, compact support on GLN of K, which were bi-invariant under the maximal compact GLNO. Okay? So these are smooth functions . So this is the convolution algebra of locally constant functions of compact support GLNK, which are by GLNO invariant. Right? That's what those are. And we talked about them when we talked about automorphic representations a long time ago. Okay? Here's some examples. For example, this algebra contains what I'm going to call the functions phi I. And so what's an easy way to make GLNO invariant functions? Well, I can just take double cosets. I can take characteristic functions of certain double cosets. Okay? So for example, I can do the following. Take the characteristic of the double coset that has the uniformizer down the diagonal, I times, and then 1 down the diagonal. Okay? Those are surely in there. Right? Those are surely in there. Okay. Now, actually, I'll say this right now. If I do GL2, and I take the field just to be QP, then, I'll put that up here. So if G is equal to GL2, the field is equal to QP, then phi1, which is the characteristic function then of GL2O P001. This is really, if you do the passage back and forth from classical to adelic to local, that's TP. That's TP. So let me tell you, this is going to be the Hecke algebra that we're going to use in place of the classical Hecke algebra. And let me at least leave you with one fact about the classical Hecke, about this spherical Hecke algebra, and that is this thing is in fact a commutative algebra. Okay? And generated by eyes. Okay. Just like, remember the usual Hecke algebra was generated by the TPs, we proved that. And here I'm basically fixing a P, and I'm saying that the local spherical Hecke algebra is generated by these sorts of TPs. You put a certain number of P's or uniformizer down the diagonal and then once. Okay. Now, let me at least outline a little bit about how we're going to do this calculation. Okay? Well, what happens? If I take an unramified representation, it's got a k-fixed vector. Okay? So I have a k-fixed vector. Now, these are k-bi-invariant functions. If you remember, these things sort of project onto the k-fixed vectors. So if I take a k-fixed vector and hit it by one of these, so I should note here, for any smooth representation, and this we actually saw in the case of representations in terms of functions, I believe, for any smooth representation of GLN, either H, the full Hecke algebra, or the spherical Hecke algebra acts on V pi by convolutions. So pi phi of V is going to be the integral over G phi of g, pi of gv. Okay. Now, this is smooth. The stabilizer of this is a compact open subgroup. This has compact support. This is a finite sum, really. So this is, even though I've written it as an integral, it's really a finite sum. These are sort of easy to deal with. Yes? Oh, there's nothing wrong with me having extra generators. Well, yeah. I like zero, though, because if I put in zero, then that's just the characteristic function of GLNO. I like that one. I want that one. Okay. So here's what we're going to do now. I take an unramified representation. It's got a k-fixed vector in it, right? I hold it in my hand. If I hit it by something in this, I do this action, the thing I get back is a k-fixed vector. There's only one up to scalars, and so the action of this commutative algebra on this vector always gives me back a multiple of itself. That multiple will be a character of this algebra. Okay? That's step number one. That's my eigenfunction, and that character is my eigenvalue. Okay? Now, so I've got an eigenvalue. Okay? Well, it turns out it's a theorem that if I have an unramified generic representation, it's a full induced representation from characters of the Borel. I have a model coming from that, the fact that it's an induced representation, and in that model, I can actually compute the action of these generators. In other words, I can use that model to actually compute what the eigenvalue is. So we're going to compute a formula for the eigenvalue explicitly. And so I do that. I do the calculation, that induced model, and I sit it over here. I have my eigenvalue. But now I say, well, really I'm interested in Whittaker functions. Well, I can do the same calculation for the Whittaker functions. When I do, it turns out I get a recursion relation. I get exactly this recursion relation. And so I get a recursion relation on for the Whittaker functions somehow being equal to this eigenvalue that I've already computed. So you'll have to be patient. You'll have to be patient. Okay, but you get some sort of a recursion relation, like relating, you get a recursion relation relating how these various things act, if you like. And then you solve the recursion relation using representation theory of finite dimensional representations of GLN. And when you do, you have an explicit function for these, which came out of doing these two things. And then you just take it and you put it in the integral and you do the integral. And that evaluates this. And then you do a little bit to get to there. So that's what we will do on next Tuesday. We're going to do these calculations. But that's the idea. Okay. And I'm still late. But I promise, next Thursday, I will finish Lecture 7, and we will be exactly one lecture behind. Next Thursday, I'll be doing something else. Next Tuesday, by the end of next Tuesday, I should be exactly one lecture behind, and so we'll start afresh every day, I hope.